I have seen both men and women miss out on great opportunities by focusing too much on career levels. A friend of mine had been working as a lawyer for 4 years when she realized that instead of shooting for partner, she'd rather join a company in a sales or marketing role. One of her clients was willing to hire her in this new capacity, but wanted her to start at the ground level. Since she could afford the temporary pay cut, I urged her to make the jump. But she decided against taking a job that put her back 4 years. I understood how painful it was for her to lose hard-earned ground. Still, my argument was that if she was going to work for the next 30 years, what difference does going back 4 years really make? If the other path made her happier and offered her a chance to learn new skills, that meant she was actually moving forward. In many cases, women need to be more open to taking risks in their careers. When I left Google to join Facebook, as a percentage of my team, fewer women tried to follow me. As they had been all along, the men were more interested in new and, as we say in tech, higher beta opportunities, where the risks were great, but the potential rewards even greater. Many of the women on my team eventually showed interest in joining Facebook, but not until a few years later, when the company was more established. The cost of stability is often diminished opportunities for growth. Of course, there are times in life when being risk-averse is a good thing. Adolescent and adult males drown in much greater numbers than adolescent and adult females. But in business, being risk-averse can result in stagnation. An analysis of senior corporate management appointments found that women are significantly more likely than men to continue to perform the same function even when they take on new duties. And when female managers move up, they are more likely to do so internally instead of switching to a different company. At times, staying in the same functional area and in the same organization creates inertia and limits opportunity to expand. Seeking out diverse experiences is useful preparation for leadership. I understand the external pressures that force women to play it safe and stay put. Gender stereotypes can make it hard to move into positions traditionally held by men. Women are also more likely to accommodate a partner's career than the other way around. A job change that includes moving to another city may be a non-starter for a woman in a relationship. The result is the unfortunate tautology that the tendency to stay put leads to staying put. Being risk-averse in the workplace can also cause women to be more reluctant to take on challenging tasks. In my experience, more men look for stretch assignments and take on high-visibility projects, while more women hang back. Research suggests that this is particularly true for women in environments that emphasize individual performance, or when women are working closely with men. One reason women avoid stretch assignments and new challenges is that they worry too much about whether they currently have the skills they need for a new role. This can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, since so many abilities are acquired on the job. An internal report at Hewlett-Packard revealed that women only apply for open jobs if they think they meet 100% of the criteria listed. Men apply if they think they meet 60% of the requirements. This difference has a huge ripple effect. Women need to shift from thinking, "I'm not ready to do that," to thinking, "I want to do that, and I'll learn by doing it." My first day at work at the World Bank, Larry Summers asked me to perform some calculations. I was at a loss on how to proceed, so I turned to Lant Pritchett for help. "Just put it into Lotus 1-2-3," he advised. I told him that I didn't know how to do that. "Wow," he exclaimed. "I can't believe you've gotten this far, or even how you can understand basic economics without knowing how to use Lotus." I went home convinced that I was going to get fired. The next day, Lant sat me down. My heart was pounding. But instead of firing me, he taught me how to use the program. That's a great boss. Women are also more reluctant to apply for promotions even when deserved, often believing that good job performance will naturally lead to rewards. Carol Frohlinger and Deborah Kolb, founders of Negotiating Women, Inc., describe this as the tiara syndrome, where women expect that if they keep doing their job well, someone will notice them and place a tiara on their head. In a perfect meritocracy, tiaras would be doled out to the deserving, but I have yet to see one floating around an office. Hard work and results should be recognized by others, but when they aren't, advocating for oneself becomes necessary. As discussed earlier, this must be done with great care, but it must be done. Taking risks, choosing growth, challenging ourselves, and asking for promotions, with smiles on our faces, of course, are all important elements of managing a career. One of my favorite quotes comes from author Alice Walker, who observed, "The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any." Do not wait for power to be offered. Like that tiara, it might never materialize. And anyway, who wears a tiara on a jungle gym? Chapter 5. Are you my mentor? When I was a child, one of my favorite books was Are You My Mother? The story of a baby bird that emerges from its shell to discover an empty nest. The hatchling heads off in search of its missing mother, asking a kitten, a hen, a dog, and a cow the burning question, Are you my mother? Each animal responds, No. The hatchling grows more desperate, eventually shouting, Are you my mother? At a car, a boat, a plane, and even a steam shovel, which can only respond with a loud snort. Stuck in the shovel's jaws, the hatchling appears doomed until, miraculously, the shovel lifts the bird back to its nest. The mother returns and the hatchling announces, You are a bird and you are my mother! This children's book poignantly mirrors the professional question. Are you my mentor? If someone has to ask the question, the answer is probably no. When someone finds the right mentor, it is obvious. The question becomes a statement. Chasing or forcing that connection rarely works, and yet I see women attempt this all the time. When I give speeches or attend meetings, a startling number of women introduce themselves and, in the same breath, ask me to be their mentor. I cannot recall a single man asking me to do the same, although men have asked me to mentor their wives or girlfriends. The question is a total mood killer, the equivalent of turning to a pensive date and asking, What are you thinking? Every senior woman I have talked to about this is deluged with the same request. Their reaction is unanimous. Oh, I never know what to say when people I don't know ask me to be their mentor. The interaction is flattering, but awkward. Even media mogul Oprah Winfrey, who has taught so much to an entire generation, admits that she feels uncomfortable when someone asks her to be a mentor. She once explained, I mentor when I see something and say, I want to see that grow. In part, we've brought this on ourselves. For the past decade, talk of mentorship and sponsorship has been topic number one at any women's career seminar. It is the focus of blogs, newspaper articles, and research reports. Many of these young women are responding to the often repeated advice that if they want to scale the corporate ladder, they need to find mentors, people who will advise them, as well as sponsors. People who will use their influence to advocate for them. The emphasis on finding a mentor became especially clear to me when I went back to speak at Harvard Business School in the spring of 2011. I was invited by Dean Nitin Noria, who joined me on stage and conducted the interview. His first question centered on Facebook and what it was like to work for Mark. I told him that I loved it, except on days when co-workers said things like, "Cheryl, can you look at this? We need to know what old people will think of this feature." We discussed the Arab Spring and a slew of other timely topics. Dean Noria then asked me a question about women in the workforce. I'm not sure what possessed me, but I turned to look at the audience, paused, and answered with brutal honesty. If current trends continue, 15 years from today, about one-third of the women in this audience will be working full-time, and almost all of you will be working for the guy you are sitting next to. Dead silence in the large auditorium. I continued. I'm sorry if this sounds harsh or surprises anyone, but this is where we are. If you want the outcome to be different, you will have to do something about it. On that strained note, Dean Noria ended the interview and turned to the audience for a Q&A. A number of men leapt to the microphone and posed thoughtful, big-picture questions like, "What did you learn at Google that you are applying at Facebook?" and "How do you run a platform company and ensure stability for your developers?" Then two women rose to the microphone. The first asked, "Do you think it's okay to work for a company that competes with the company you worked for before business school?" The second asked, "How can I get a mentor?" My heart sank. The men were focusing on how to manage a business, and the women were focusing on how to manage a career. The men wanted answers, and the women wanted permission and help. I realized that searching for a mentor has become the professional equivalent of waiting for Prince Charming. We all grew up on the fairy tale Sleeping Beauty, which instructs young women that if they just wait for their prince to arrive, they will be kissed and whisked away on a white horse to live happily ever after. Now young women are told that if they can just find the right mentor, they will be pushed up the ladder and whisked away to the corner office to live happily ever after. Once again, we are teaching women to be too dependent on others. To be clear, the issue is not whether mentorship is important. It is. Mentorship and sponsorship are crucial for career progression. Both men and women with sponsors are more likely to ask for stretch assignments and pay raises than their peers of the same gender without sponsors. Unfortunately for women, men often have an easier time acquiring and maintaining these relationships. One recent study shows that men are significantly more likely than women to be sponsored, and that those with sponsors are more satisfied with their rates of advancement. Because it is harder for young women to find mentors and sponsors, they are taking a more active role in seeking them out. And while normally I applaud assertive behavior, this energy is sometimes misdirected. No matter how crucial these connections are, they probably won't develop from asking a virtual stranger, "Will you be my mentor?" The strongest relationships spring out of a real and often earned connection felt by both sides. I've been lucky to have strong mentors and sponsors over the course of my career. The acknowledgments in this book include a long list of people who have been generous enough to guide and advise me. During my junior year of college, I took Larry Summers' public sector economics class. He offered to supervise my senior thesis, something very few Harvard professors volunteer to do for undergraduates. Larry has been a major part of my life ever since. I met Don Graham, chairman of the Washington Post Company, more than 15 years ago when I was working in D.C., and he has helped me navigate some of my most challenging professional situations. If it hadn't been for Paley Center CEO Pat Mitchell's encouragement and support, I might never have spoken publicly about women in the workplace. These three, among so many others, have encouraged me, made introductions, and taught me by example. Their wisdom helped me avoid mistakes and clean up the ones I wasn't smart enough to avoid. In turn, I have tried to mentor others, including friends of friends, and as I get older, children of friends. I get so much joy out of watching the career of Emily White, who started working with me right out of college and now runs mobile partnerships for Facebook. When I first met Brian Schreier, he had never worked in a tech company or traveled abroad, but he displayed unusually strong leadership and analytical skills. I hired him to help build Google's global operations, and he exceeded every expectation. Years later, when he wanted to pursue a new career as an investor, I introduced him to his current partners at Sequoia Capital. He is now a highly successful early-stage venture capitalist, and I can see the impact he has on the companies he advises. I am fortunate to have Emily and Brian and so many other talented people in my life. Studies show that mentors select protégés based on performance and potential. Intuitively, people invest in those who stand out for their talent or who can really benefit from help. Mentors continue to invest when mentees use their time well and are truly open to feedback. It may turn into a friendship, but the foundation is a professional relationship. Given this, I believe we have sent the wrong message to young women. We need to stop telling them, "Get a mentor and you will excel." Instead, we need to tell them, "Excel and you will get a mentor." Clara Shih is a superb example. I met Clara about 5 years ago at a conference and was immediately impressed by her ideas about social media. She went on to write a thoughtful book on the subject and founded Hearsay Social, a software company that helps businesses manage their social media presence. Every so often, Clara would contact me, always with an interesting point or a thoughtful question. She never asked to get together to catch up. She never asked a question that she could have found the answer to on her own. When I was leaving the Starbucks board of directors in 2012, I gave them a few names of social media experts who might join in my place and included Clara. She was only 29 years old at the time, but she was invited to join the board. While asking a stranger to be a mentor rarely, if ever, works, approaching a stranger with a pointed, well-thought-out inquiry can yield results. Garrett Nieman stopped me after I gave a speech at Stanford to explain that he had founded College Spring, a nonprofit that provides SAT tutoring and college counseling to low-income students. He wanted to meet with me and made it clear that he only needed a few minutes of my time to ask for introductions to some people who could help expand his organization. He had done his homework and knew that I cared deeply about education. In our first meeting, and in every interaction we've had since, Garrett has been respectful of my time. He is crisp, focused, and gracious. And he always follows up to let me know the results of our discussion. Capturing someone's attention or imagination in a minute can be done, but only when planned and tailored to that individual. Leading with a vague question such as, "What is Facebook's culture like?" shows more ignorance than interest in the company, since there are hundreds of articles that provide this answer. Preparation is especially important when looking for a job. When I left the Treasury Department, former Chief of Staff Josh Steiner gave me great advice about asking for advice. He told me to figure out what I wanted to do before I went to see the people who had the ability to hire me. That way, I would not waste my one shot seeking general guidance, but would be able to discuss specific opportunities that they could offer. Mentorship is often a more reciprocal relationship than it may appear, especially in situations where people are already working at the same company. The mentee may receive more direct assistance, but the mentor receives benefits too, including useful information, greater commitment from colleagues, and a sense of fulfillment and pride. Sociologists and psychologists have long observed our deep desire to participate in reciprocal behavior. The fact that humans feel obligated to return favors has been documented in virtually all societies and underpins all kinds of social relationships. The mentor-mentee relationship is no exception. When done right, everybody flourishes. Erin Burnett, now a well-known CNN journalist, credits Willow Bay, a veteran TV correspondent and editor, for mentoring her when she first started out. Willow was a brand new anchor of Moneyline, but did not have deep financial experience. Erin had worked at Goldman Sachs, which made her an ideal person for Willow to hire as an assistant. Erin impressed Willow with her ambition, work ethic, and talent. Meanwhile, Erin got to watch a savvy, established journalist up close and personal. Each benefited from the other's expertise. Justin Osofsky caught my attention at Facebook years ago when we were getting ready for our first senior-level meeting with the Walt Disney Company. Each of our teams, including sales, business development, and marketing, had submitted ideas for the partnership, but no one was coordinating, which left our presentation disjointed and unwieldy. Rather than just submitting his section, Justin took the initiative to pull the group together and integrate all the ideas. I have been mentoring him ever since, which in his case means that I often turn to Justin to solve problems. This helps the company and creates ongoing opportunities for him. Getting the attention of a senior person with a virtuoso performance works, but it's not the only way to get a mentor. I have seen lower-level employees nimbly grab a moment after a meeting or in the hall to ask advice from a respected and busy senior person. The exchange is casual and quick. After taking that advice, the would-be mentee follows up to offer thanks and then uses that opportunity to ask for more guidance. Without even realizing it, the senior person becomes involved and invested in the junior person's career. The word mentor never needs to be uttered. The relationship is more important than the label. The label itself is open to interpretation. For years, I kept an eye on an enormously talented young woman on my team at Google and advised her each time she had a major decision to make. I never used the word mentor, but I invested a lot of time in her development. So I was surprised one day when she stated flatly that she had never had a mentor or anyone really looking out for her. I asked what a mentor meant to her. She explained that it would be someone she spoke to for at least an hour every week. I smiled, thinking, that's not a mentor, that's a therapist. Few mentors have time for excessive hand-holding. Most are dealing with their own high-stress jobs. A mentee who is positive and prepared can be a bright spot in a day. For this same reason, mentees should avoid complaining excessively to a mentor. Using a mentor's time to validate feelings may help psychologically, but it's better to focus on specific problems with real solutions. Most people in the position to mentor are quite adept at problem solving. Give them a problem to solve. Sometimes high potential women have a difficult time asking for help because they don't want to appear stumped. Being unsure about how to proceed is the most natural feeling in the world. I feel that way all the time. Asking for input is not a sign of weakness, but often the first step to finding a path forward. Mentoring and sponsoring relationships often form between individuals who have common interests, or when the junior members remind the more senior members of themselves. This means that men will often gravitate towards sponsoring younger men, with whom they connect more naturally. Since there are so many more men at the top of every industry, the proverbial old boy network continues to flourish. And since there are already a reduced number of women in leadership roles, it is not possible for the junior women to get enough support unless senior men jump in too. We need to make male leaders aware of this shortage and encourage them to widen their circle. It's wonderful when senior men mentor women. It's even better when they champion and sponsor them. Any male leader who is serious about moving toward a more equal world can make this a priority and be part of the solution. It should be a badge of honor for men to sponsor women. And since we know that different perspectives improve performance, companies should foster and reward this behavior. Of course, there are some tricky issues to be solved here, including the perceived sexual context of male-female relationships. Once during my treasury years, Larry Summers and I traveled together to South Africa, where we hold up in the living room of his hotel suite to work on his speech on fiscal policy for the next day. Jet-lagged and oblivious to the time change, we suddenly noticed it was 3 a.m. We both knew it would look awful if anyone saw me leaving his hotel suite at that time. We discussed the options. Maybe he should check to see if anyone was in the hall? Then we realized we were stuck, because there is no difference between trying not to be seen leaving someone's hotel room late at night and actually leaving someone's hotel room late at night. I strode into the luckily empty hall and made it to my room undetected. Junior women and senior men often avoid engaging in mentoring or sponsoring relationships out of fear of what others might think. A study published by the Center for Work-Life Policy and the Harvard Business Review reported that 64% of men at the level of vice president and above are hesitant to have a one-on-one meeting with a more junior woman. For their part, half of the junior women avoided close contact with senior men. This evasiveness must end. Personal connections lead to assignments and promotions, so it needs to be okay for men and women to spend informal time together the same way men can. A senior man and a junior man at a bar is seen as mentoring. A senior man and a junior woman at a bar can also be mentoring, but it looks like dating. This interpretation holds women back and creates a double bind. If women try to cultivate a close relationship with a male sponsor, they risk being the target of workplace gossip. If women try to get to the top without a sponsor's help, their careers will often stall. We cannot assume that interactions between men and women have a sexual component, and everyone involved has to make sure to behave professionally so women and men feel safe in all settings. At Goldman Sachs in the late 1990s, management committee partner Bob Steele recognized this perception problem and came up with an admirable solution. The father of three daughters, Steele told a training class that he had a breakfast or lunch only policy with employees because he felt uncomfortable going out to dinner with female employees and wanted to make access equal. Sharon Mears worked at Goldman at the time and said Steele's decision caused a bit of a stir, but she thought his candor was heroic. Anything that evens out the opportunities for men and women is the right practice. Some will get there by adopting a no-dinner policy. Others may adopt a dinner-with-anyone policy. In either case, we need practices that can be applied evenly. Many companies are starting to move from informal mentoring that relies on individual initiative to more formal programs. When taken seriously, these formal mentorship sponsorship programs can be remarkably successful. Structured programs also take the pressure off junior women from having to ask the difficult, "Are you my mentor?" question. One study showed that women who found mentors through formal programs were 50% more likely to be promoted than women who found mentors on their own. The most effective formal programs help educate men about the need to mentor women and establish guidelines for appropriate behavior. These programs can be a great way to help normalize the senior man, junior woman model. Official mentorship programs are not sufficient by themselves and work best when combined with other kinds of development and training. Deloitte's Leading to Win Women's Initiative is a good example. Deloitte had already established a program to support female employees who still remained underrepresented at the highest levels of the company. This prompted Chet Wood, CEO of Deloitte Tax, to ask, "Where are all the women?" In response, Deloitte launched a leadership development program in 2008. The program targeted senior women in the tax division who were close to promotion. The women were assigned sponsors, received executive coaching, shadowed members of the executive committee, and took on global assignments. Of the 21 members of the inaugural group, 18 have since been promoted. As helpful as these formal programs can be, they are not always offered, and in some situations, senior people are not available to give guidance. The good news is that guidance can come from all levels. When I first joined Facebook, One of my biggest challenges was setting up the necessary business processes without harming the freewheeling culture. The company operated by moving quickly and tolerating mistakes, and lots of people were nervous that I would not just ruin the party, but squash innovation. Naomi Gleit had joined Facebook right out of college several years earlier. As one of Facebook's earliest employees, she had a deep understanding of how the company worked. Naomi and I became close. I bet most people, including Naomi herself, probably assumed that I was mentoring her. But the truth is, she mentored me. She helped me implement the changes that needed to be made and jumped in to stop me from getting things wrong. Naomi always told me the truth, even if she thought it would be hard for me to hear. She still does this for me today. Peers can also mentor and sponsor one another. There is a saying that all advice is autobiographical. Friends at the same stage of their careers may actually provide more current and useful counsel. Several of my older mentors advised me against taking a job at Google in 2001, yet almost all my peers understood the potential of Silicon Valley. Peers are also in the trenches and may understand problems that superiors do not, especially when those problems are generated by superiors in the first place. As an associate at McKinsey & Company, my first assignment was on a team that consisted of a male senior engagement manager, SEM, and two other male associates, Abe Wu and Derek Hawley. When the SEM wanted to talk to Abe or Derek, he would walk over to their desks. When he wanted to talk to me, he would sit at his desk and shout, "Sandberg, get over here!" with the tone one might use to call a child, or even worse, a dog. It made me cringe every time. I never said anything, but one day Abe and Derek started calling each other Sandberg in that same loud voice. The self-absorbed SEM never seemed to notice. They kept it up. When having too many Sandbergs got confusing, they decided we needed to differentiate. Abe started calling himself Asian Sandberg. Derek dubbed himself Good-Looking Sandberg. And I became Sandberg Sandberg. My colleagues turned an awful situation into one where I felt protected. They stood up for me and made me laugh. They were the best mentors I could have had. Since when it rains, it pours. On that same project, the senior client leader wanted to fix me up with his son. He declared this intention in front of his team over and over. I knew he meant it as a compliment, but it undermined my professional authority. How could I get my clients to take me seriously if their boss was constantly reminding everyone that I was his son's age? Oh, and that I should date him. One day, I gathered my courage and asked to speak to him in private. I told him, nicely, that I did not think it was appropriate for him to keep bringing up his son. He laughed it off and kept doing it. Having tried to deal with the situation myself, I went to my manager, the same Sandberg shouting SEM. He listened to my complaint and then told me that I should think about what I was doing to send these signals. Yep, it was my fault. I told the two other Sandbergs, who were outraged. They encouraged me to go over the SEM's head and talk to the senior partner, Robert Taylor. Robert understood my discomfort immediately. He explained that sometimes those of us who are different, he is African American, need to remind people to treat us appropriately. He said he was glad I told the client no on my own and that the client should have listened. He then talked to the client and explained that his behavior had to stop. He also spoke with my SEM about his insensitive response. I could not have been more grateful for Robert's protection. I knew exactly how that baby bird felt when he finally found his mother. Chapter 6. Seek and speak your truth. My friend Betsy Cohen was pregnant with her second child when her toddler Sam became curious about where the baby was in her body. "Mommy," he asked, Are the baby's arms in your arms? No, the baby is in my tummy, she replied. Are the baby's legs in your legs? No, the whole baby is in my tummy. Really? The whole baby is in your tummy? Are you sure? Yes, the whole baby is in my tummy. Then, Mommy, what's growing in your butt? This kind of honesty is common from children and virtually unheard of from adults. As kids grow up, we teach them to be polite, watch what they say, not hurt others' feelings. This is not a bad thing. As a former pregnant whale, I'm glad that most people keep some observations to themselves. But as we learn to speak appropriately, we lose something in authenticity. Authentic communication is not always easy, but it is the basis for successful relationships at home and real effectiveness at work. Yet people constantly back away from honesty to protect themselves and others. This reticence causes and perpetuates all kinds of problems. Uncomfortable issues that never get addressed, resentment that builds, unfit managers who get promoted rather than fired, and on and on. Often these situations don't improve because no one tells anyone what is really happening. We are so rarely brave enough to tell the truth. Being honest in the workplace is especially difficult. All organizations have some form of hierarchy, which means that someone's performance is assessed by someone else's perception. This makes people even less likely to tell the truth. Every organization faces this challenge, no matter how flat it tries to be. At Facebook, we work hard to be non-hierarchical. Everyone sits at open desks in big open spaces. No offices, cubes, or partitions for any of us. We hold a company-wide Q&A every Friday where anyone can ask a question or make a comment. When people disagree with decisions, they post to the company-wide Facebook group. Still, I would be an idiot, or not telling myself the truth, if I thought that my coworkers always felt free to criticize me, Mark, or even their peers. When psychologists study power dynamics, they find that people in low power positions are more hesitant to share their views and often hedge their statements when they do. This helps explain why, for many women, speaking honestly in a professional environment carries an additional set of fears. Fear of not being considered a team player. Fear of seeming negative or nagging. Fear that constructive criticism will come across as just plain old criticism. Fear that by speaking up, we will call attention to ourselves, which might open us up to attack. A fear brought to us by that same voice in the back of our heads that urges us not to sit at the table. Communication works best when we combine appropriateness with authenticity, finding that sweet spot where opinions are not brutally honest, but delicately honest. Speaking truthfully without hurting feelings comes naturally to some and is an acquired skill for others. I definitely needed help in this area. Fortunately, I found it. When Dave was at Yahoo, he attended a management training program taught by Fred Kaufman, a former MIT professor and author of Conscious Business. Dave hates training of any kind, and the human resources team at Yahoo had to force him to attend the 2-day session. When he came home after the first day, he surprised me by describing the training as not too bad. By the end of the second day, he started quoting Fred and making observations about our communication. I was in shock. This guy must be good. So I called Fred, introduced myself, and said, "I don't know what you do, but I want you to do it for my team at Google." Fred showed up at Google, and his teachings changed my career and my life. He is one of the most extraordinary thinkers on leadership and management I have ever encountered. Many of the concepts discussed in this chapter originated with him and reflect his belief that great leadership is conscious leadership. I learned from Fred that effective communication starts with the understanding that there is my point of view, my truth, and someone else's point of view, his truth. Rarely is there one absolute truth. So people who believe that they speak the truth are very silencing of others. When we recognize that we can see things only from our own perspective, we can share our views in a non-threatening way. Statements of opinion are always more constructive in the first person I form. Compare these two statements. You never take my suggestions seriously. And I feel frustrated that you have not responded to my last four emails, which leads me to believe that my suggestions are not that important to you. Is that so? The former can elicit a quick and defensive, "That's not true." The latter is much harder to deny. One triggers a disagreement, the other sparks a discussion. I wish I could always maintain this perspective in all my communications. I don't, but I continue to try. Truth is also better served by using simple language. Office speak often contains nuances and parentheticals that can bury not just the lead, but the entire point. Comedies like Office Space ring true for a reason. People fear insulting others, especially the boss, so they hedge. Rather than stating, "I disagree with our expansion strategy," they say, "While I think there are many good reasons why we are opening this new line of business, and I feel confident that the management team has done a thorough ROI analysis, I am not sure we have completely thought through all of the downstream effects of taking this step forward at this time." Huh? With all of these caveats, it's hard to decipher what the speaker actually thinks. When communicating hard truths, less is often more. A few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg decided to learn Chinese. To practice, he spent time with a group of Facebook employees who were native speakers. One might think that Mark's limited language skills would have kept these conversations from being substantively useful. Instead, they gave him greater insight into what was going on in the company. For example, one of the women was trying to tell Mark something about her manager. Mark didn't understand, so he said, "Simpler, please." Then she spoke again, but he still didn't understand, so he had to ask her to simplify further. This happened a few more times. Eventually, she got frustrated and just blurted out, "My manager is bad." She was still speaking Chinese, but simply enough that Mark understood. If more people were this clear, the performance of many organizations would improve dramatically. The ability to listen is as important as the ability to speak. From the time my siblings and I were very young, whenever we had arguments, our mother taught us, or more like forced us, to mirror each other, which means restating the other person's point before responding to it. For example, one day my sister and I were fighting over a lollipop. "Cheryl ate the last lollipop," Michelle screamed. "But she had a lollipop yesterday and I didn't," I screamed back, making an excellent point. My mother sat us down facing each other. I was not allowed to explain how gravely inequitable the lollipop allocation was until I acknowledged my sister's feelings. "Michelle, I understand that you are upset because I ate the last lollipop and you wanted it." As painful as this was at the time, reflecting someone's viewpoint clarifies the disagreement and becomes a starting point for resolution. We all want to be heard, and when we focus on showing others that we are listening, we actually become better listeners. I now do this with my children. And while they probably dislike the process as much as I did when I was their age, I love hearing my son explain to my daughter, "I'm sorry you're upset because you lost at Monopoly, but I'm older than you, so I should win." Not bad for a 7-year-old. Although Fred would caution my son to take out the "but" and everything after, since it tends to deny the preceding statement. Imagine someone saying, "I really like you, but..." Being aware of a problem is the first step to correcting it. It is nearly impossible to know how our actions are perceived by others. We can try to guess what they're thinking, but asking directly is far more effective. With real knowledge, we can adjust our actions and avoid getting tripped up. Still, people rarely seek enough input. A few years ago, Tom Brokaw interviewed me for a piece on Facebook. Tom is a magnificent interviewer, and I felt that I stumbled through some of my answers. After we wrapped, I asked him how I could have done better. He seemed surprised by my question, so I asked him again. He then told me that in his entire career, I was only the second person to ask him for feedback. The strategy of soliciting input broadly was first demonstrated for me by Robert Rubin, Secretary of the Treasury when I joined the department in 1996. During my first week there, I was invited to a meeting on restructuring the IRS. About 10 senior staffers were sitting at the table when we entered. Since I knew nothing about the topic, I took a seat in the back corner of the room. Yep, not even close to the table. Toward the end of the meeting, Secretary Rubin suddenly turned and asked, "Cheryl, what do you think?" I was stunned silent. My mouth opened, but nothing came out. When he saw how shocked I was, Secretary Rubin explained why he had put me on the spot. "Because you're new and not fully up to speed on how we do things, I thought you might see something we were missing." Apparently not, in my case. But Secretary Rubin sent a powerful message to all of us about the value of soliciting ideas from every corner. Literally. Secretary Rubin was also aware of the dangers of blindly following leaders, or in his case, being blindly followed. Before becoming Treasury Secretary, Rubin served as co-chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs. At the end of his first week as co-chairman, he noticed that Goldman was heavily invested in gold. He asked someone why the firm had taken such a big position. The startled employee answered, "That was you, sir." "Me?" Rubin replied. Apparently, the day before he had been taking his initial tour of the trading floor and commented, "Gold looks interesting." This got repeated as, "Rubin likes gold," and someone spent millions of dollars to please the new boss. More than a decade later, I experienced my own "Rubin likes gold" moment. When I joined Facebook, I faced a dilemma. I needed to bolster the business side of the company while respecting its unconventional culture. Most corporations love PowerPoint presentations, so I encouraged people not to prepare them for meetings with me, but instead to come with a simple list of topics. I repeated this frequently, but every meeting seemed to include a detailed PowerPoint presentation anyway. After more than 2 years of frustration, I announced that although I hated making rules, I was making one: no more PowerPoint in my meetings. A few weeks later, as I was getting ready to speak to our global sales team, Kirsten Neville Manning, a skilled human resources leader at Facebook, came to find me. Kirsten thought I should know that everyone in Europe was upset with me. Really? I angered an entire continent? She explained that client meetings were very difficult without PowerPoint and asked why I would make such a stupid rule. I explained that I had intended the rule to apply only to presentations to me. But just as the Goldman team heard, "Gold equals good," the Facebook team heard, "PowerPoint equals bad." I got on stage in front of our entire sales team and apologized for the misunderstanding. I also let them know that if they hear a bad idea, even one they believe is coming from me or Mark, they should either fight it or ignore it. As hard as it is to have an honest dialogue about business decisions, it is even harder to give individuals honest feedback. This is true for entry-level employees, senior leaders, and everyone in between. One thing that helps is to remember that feedback, like truth, is not absolute. Feedback is an opinion, grounded in observations and experiences, which allows us to know what impression we make on others. The information is revealing and potentially uncomfortable, which is why all of us would rather offer feedback to those who welcome it. If I make an observation or recommendation and someone reacts badly, or even just visibly tenses up, I quickly learn to save my comments for things that really matter. This is why I so admire Molly Graham's approach. Molly joined Facebook in 2008 and held a number of jobs throughout the company in communications, human resources, and mobile products. She performed extraordinarily well in all of these very different roles, not just because she is uniquely talented, but because she is always learning. One day, she and I hosted a tricky client meeting. She navigated the discussion effectively, and after the clients left, I praised her effort. She paused and said, "Thanks, but you must have ideas for me on what more I could have done. How can I do better? What am I doing that I don't know? What am I not doing that I don't see?" These questions can lead to many benefits. And believe me, the truth hurts. Even when I have solicited feedback, any judgment can feel harsh. But the upside of painful knowledge is so much greater than the downside of blissful ignorance. Requesting advice can also help build relationships. At Facebook, I knew that the most important determinant of my success would be my relationship with Mark. When I joined, I asked Mark for a commitment that he would give me feedback every week so that anything that bothered him would be aired and discussed quickly. Mark not only said yes, but immediately added that he wanted it to be reciprocal. For the first few years, we stuck to this routine and voiced concerns big and small every Friday afternoon. As the years went by, sharing honest reactions became part of our ongoing relationship. Now we do so in real time rather than waiting for the end of the week. I wouldn't suggest that all relationships need this much feedback. There is such a thing as asking for too much. But for us, it has been critically important. I have also learned the hard way that being open to hearing the truth means taking responsibility for mistakes. In my first week as Chief of Staff at Treasury, I had the chance to work directly with the heads of the department bureaus. There is a right and a wrong way to start a working relationship. I chose the wrong way. My first call was to Ray Kelly, who was then Commissioner of the U.S. Customs Service and now serves as New York City's Police Commissioner. Instead of reaching out to offer assistance, I called Commissioner Kelly with a request from the Secretary. The impression I made was that my job was to demand and his job was to listen. It was a mistake. Ray's response was quick and clear. Expletive, "Cheryl," he explained. "Just because I'm not in Larry Summers," expletive, "30-year-old brain trust doesn't mean that I don't know what I'm doing. If Secretary Summers wants something from me, tell him to," expletive, "call me himself." Then he hung up the phone. I thought, this is not going well. My first week on the job, and I'd angered a man who knows a thing or two about firearms. After I stopped shaking, I realized that Commissioner Kelly had done me a huge favor. His feedback was extremely helpful and delivered in a way that I would never forget. I reassessed my outreach strategy. With the other bureau chiefs, I initiated conversation by asking what I could do to help them achieve their goals. It's no surprise that they reacted more positively and with far fewer expletives. And after I employed my "what have I done for you lately" approach, they were far more eager to return the favor. As often as I try to persuade people to share their honest views, it is still a challenge to elicit them. When I started building my team at Google, I interviewed every candidate before we made an offer. Even when the team had grown to about 100 people, I still spoke with each finalist. One day at a meeting of my direct reports, I offered to stop interviewing, fully expecting everyone to insist that my input was an essential part of the process. Instead, they applauded. They all jumped in to explain, in unison, that my insistence on speaking personally to every candidate had become a huge bottleneck. I had no idea that I had been holding the team back and was upset that no one had told me. I spent a few hours quietly fuming, which, given that I have no poker face, was probably obvious to everyone. Then I realized that if my colleagues had kept this to themselves, I was clearly not communicating that I was open to their input. Miscommunication is always a two-way street. If I wanted more suggestions, I would have to take responsibility for making that clear. So I went back to my team and agreed that I would not interview anymore. And more important, I told them that I wanted their input early and often. Another way I try to foster authentic communication is to speak openly about my own weaknesses. To highlight just one, I have a tendency to get impatient about unresolved situations. My reaction is to push for people to resolve them quickly, in some cases before they realistically can. David Fisher and I have worked closely together for 15 years at Treasury, Google, and Facebook. He jokes that he can tell from my tone of voice whether he should bother to complete a task or if I'm about to just do it myself. I acknowledge my impatience openly and ask my colleagues to let me know when I need to chill out. By mentioning this myself, I give others permission to bring up my impatience and joke about it too. My colleagues will say to me, "Cheryl, you asked us to tell you when you get nervous and push the teams too hard. I think you're doing that now." But if I never said anything, would anyone at Facebook walk up to me and announce, "Hey, Cheryl, calm down. You're driving everyone nuts"? Somehow, I doubt it. They would think it. They might even say it to one another, but they wouldn't say it to me. When people are open and honest, thanking them publicly encourages them to continue while sending a powerful signal to others. At a meeting with about 60 Facebook engineers, I mentioned that I was interested in opening more Facebook offices around the world, especially in one particular region. Since the group included members of the security team, I asked what they were most worried about. Without being called on, Chad Green blurted out, "Opening a Facebook office in that region." He explained why it wouldn't work and why I was dead wrong in front of the entire group. I loved it. We had never met before, and I will never forget that strong introduction. I ended the meeting by thanking Chad for his candor, and then posted the story on Facebook to encourage the rest of the company to follow his example. Mark feels the same way. At a summer barbecue 4 years ago, an intern told Mark that he should work on his public speaking skills. Mark thanked him in front of everyone, and then encouraged us to extend him a full-time job offer. Humor can be an amazing tool for delivering an honest message in a good-natured way. A recent study even found that sense of humor was the phrase most frequently used to describe the most effective leaders. I have seen humor get results so many times. After working in the Obama White House, Marnie Levine joined Facebook to run global public policy. Marnie is polished, professional, and highly competent. During her first week at her job, she needed a colleague from another team to finish drafting a few paragraphs for an upcoming congressional testimony. The colleague was dragging his heels. He kept coming to Marnie to ask questions, which she would duly answer, then she would wait, but still no paragraphs. When he came to her again with yet another question, she turned to him with a huge smile and said, "I am going to answer all of your questions. I really am. But right now, the only thing that is going to keep me from falling down on the floor and having a heart attack right in front of you is for you to get out of your chair, go back to your desk, and write the paragraphs we need for Congress." It worked beautifully. A colleague at Google, Adam Fried, and I were frustrated by someone at work who was making our jobs very difficult. I met with her several times and earnestly explained that I felt that she was second-guessing our every move and preventing progress. During each heartfelt discussion, she would listen and nod and thank me for raising the matter. I would leave feeling better. Then the situation would get worse. Adam took a totally different approach. He invited her to lunch. They met at the Google Cafe, chatted a bit, and then he looked at her and jokingly asked, "Why do you hate me?" Where I had failed repeatedly, Adam broke through. She asked why he would make that joke, which gave him a chance to explain in a way she was able to hear. Unfortunately, our sense of humor sometimes fails us when we need it most. When I get emotional, it's very hard for me to treat a problem lightly. I had been at Google about 3 months when an uncomfortable situation erupted. I had started at the company reporting to Eric Schmidt, but was transitioning to work for Omid Kordestani. During that process, Omid and I had a major misunderstanding. I went to discuss it with him, intending to explain calmly why I was upset. But as soon as I started talking, I burst into tears. I was horrified to be crying in front of my new boss, whom I barely knew, which just made more tears flow. But I got lucky. Omid was patient and reassuring, insisting, "Everyone gets upset at work. It's okay." Most women believe, and research suggests, that it is not a good idea to cry at work. It is never something that I plan to do, and is hardly recommended in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. But on those rare occasions when I have felt really frustrated, or worse, betrayed, tears have filled my eyes. Even as I have gotten older and more experienced, it still happens every so often. I had been working at Facebook for almost a year when I learned that someone had said something about me that was not just false, but cruel. I started telling Mark about it and, despite my best efforts, started to cry. He assured me that the accusation was so untrue that no one could possibly believe it. And then he asked, "Do you want a hug?" I did. It was a breakthrough moment for us. I felt closer to him than ever before. I then recounted this story publicly, figuring that it might make it easier for others who have faced unwanted tears. The press reported the incident as, "Sheryl Sandberg cried on Mark Zuckerberg's shoulder," which is not exactly what happened. What happened was that I expressed my feelings, and Mark responded with compassion. Sharing emotions builds deeper relationships. Motivation comes from working on things we care about. It also comes from working with people we care about. To really care about others, we have to understand them, what they like and dislike, what they feel as well as think. Emotion drives both men and women and influences every decision we make. Recognizing the role emotions play and being willing to discuss them makes us better managers, partners, and peers. I did not always understand this. I used to think that being professional meant being organized and focused and keeping my personal life separate. Early on at Google, Omid and I would have a one-on-one meeting each week. I would enter his office with a typed agenda and get right to it. I thought I was being so efficient. But my colleague Tim Armstrong, who later became CEO of AOL, kindly pulled me aside one day to give me some advice. He told me that I should take a moment to connect with Omid before diving in. Since Omid and I were the only people in those meetings, it was clear who had mentioned this to Tim. I made the adjustment and started asking Omid how he was before leaping into my to-do list. It was a good lesson. An all-business approach is not always good business. It has been an evolution, but I am now a true believer in bringing our whole selves to work. I no longer think people have a professional self from Mondays through Fridays and a real self for the rest of the time. That type of separation probably never existed, and in today's era of individual expression, where people constantly update their Facebook status and tweet their every move, it makes even less sense. Instead of putting on some kind of fake all-work persona, I think we benefit from expressing our truth, talking about personal situations, and acknowledging that professional decisions are often emotionally driven. I should have learned this lesson years earlier. When I was graduating from business school in 1995, Larry Summers offered me a job at Treasury. I wanted the job desperately, but there was an issue. I did not want to move back to D.C., where my soon-to-be ex-husband lived. One of the hardest calls I've ever had to make was to tell Larry that I could not accept the job. Larry pressed me on why, and I thought about telling him that I really wanted to try consulting in Los Angeles. Instead, I opened up. I explained that I was getting divorced and wanted to move far away from D.C., which held too many painful memories. Larry argued that it was a big city, but it didn't seem big enough for me. A year later, when enough time had passed and I felt ready to return to D.C., I called Larry and asked if the opportunity was still available. It was one of the easiest calls I have ever made, in part because I had been honest the year before. If I had told Larry that I was passing on the job for professional reasons, I would have appeared impulsive when I reversed that decision. Since the real reason was personal, sharing it honestly was the best thing to do.